watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week on the program, we focused on the social and economic ramifications of the American landscape of suburban sprawl with James Howard Kunstler. One of Kunstler's themes is that the physical arrangements of suburbia are not only unsustainable, but that they both reflect and create a society that purports to represent an American dream, but has in fact become a nightmare in many ways, has not delivered the happiness it purports to sell. This week, two different examinations of mental health and happiness in America. Our first speaker will be a returning guest, Stephen Bezruchka, a medical doctor whose studies in public health and clinical experience have led him to look at social relations rather than medical models as determinants for physical and mental health. Then we'll hear a very interesting talk by Matt Ray, a sociologist at the University of Nevada, who has been studying suicide in Las Vegas. So let's begin with Stephen Bezruchka, who is a senior lecturer in the Department of Health Services at the University of Washington, as well as an emergency room physician in the Seattle area. This talk, titled "Is America Driving You Crazy?", was given late 2006 at the University of Washington.
For some time now, I've given a number of talks pointing out how the nature of a society impacts its health in very powerful ways, namely the nature of caring and sharing in a population, most often measured by the gap between the rich and the poor, determines how long we live, how well we live, and we'll discuss the point that early childhood is probably the time when the gap matters most. I always point out that the usual factors we think of as being important for our health don't matter as much, whether we smoke or not, whether we see the doctor, eat right, or exercise. While these are thought to be major factors, increasingly scientific studies are showing that to understand the foundation of health and well-being, we have to look at society and how it's organized. Tonight I'll talk about three aspects of mental health in this country. First is the study showed that we are likely the country with the most diagnosed mental illness. Second, if we actually have more mental illness as compared to other countries, a major reason for this is inherently political, beginning with how we structure early childhood in our society. Childhood is one of the most important periods for determining our long-term mental health as adults. Finally, I propose some approaches that might be necessary if we're to prevent the problem of so much mental illness in our society, given what's known about its causes. Now, what I present is substantiated in major medical journals and monographs. That is, I'll be presenting scientific material rather than my opinion, unless I clearly say I think or I believe something is true. A colleague from our Department of Psychiatry has helped me clarify issues, but of course I'm solely responsible for what I say. Today I'll delve into political issues to ask whether or not our state of mind, whether we are mad, crazy or not, whether we're down, depressed or not, anxious or not, our mental health is most profoundly impacted by the nature of caring and sharing that our society engages in. And that is impacted by the chronic stress we have created to live under. I use the term political because the root causes are the choices we make about in our society to decide who gets what share of the pie. That is what politics is all about and helps us understand mental health and mental illness. How big a gap we allow in our society, this is a choice we make, affects our lives immensely, including the meaning and purpose of our being, our friendships and support, and our health, both mental and physical. First, some personal information about me so you get a sense of why I think the way I do. Then I'll talk about the bigger picture and how this country fits into that. I'll present some options to you about what we could do to be less crazy. But first, disclaimers. I'm not a psychiatrist, nor a psychologist, nor a mental health professional, nor a counselor, but an emergency physician. And I hope by the end of the evening you'll think that I'm not crazy. I won't offer any individual advice on what you might do if you have mental illness or if others think you do. But I will offer advice for what we need to do is to regain our mental health as a nation. I'll begin by describing something that happened to me over a decade ago that was one part of my coming to think about these ideas. I'll later come back to explain what I learned from my experience in coming to understand mental health and illness. As Nikki said, I went back to graduate school in 1992 to Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health because I wondered what made a population healthy. After practicing medicine for over 20 years, I knew it wasn't medical care. In the summer of 1993, I returned to Seattle with yet another degree and some knowledge, but still no answers to my question of what made a population healthy. I'd been an ER doc for 15 years and wondered whether I should continue doing that work or devote myself full-time to public health. It was a very unsettling period for me, and there were also issues with personal relationships that clouded the picture. Over the summer, I realized I didn't feel myself. I went to a therapist I'd seen before, and she suggested maybe I was depressed and needed to see a psychiatrist. The shrink agreed I was depressed and needed treatment, and he prescribed, guess what? Prozac. I'd been seeing more and more patients on this drug that was introduced in 1987. The drug was becoming popular, helped by the book Listening to Prozac. I filled the prescription and began taking it. After a week, I felt worse in a very strange way. I just didn't feel myself. I decided not to listen to Prozac and stopped taking the drug. Eventually, that weird feeling went away, but I was still depressed. Luckily, I had arranged to go to Nepal as a consultant, armed with my new degree, to carry out an evaluation of a rural child health project, work that was new for me. I'd spent years in Nepal and felt I could do this job, even though I was feeling down. So off I went as the team leader, but lacking confidence, as you might imagine. Now, Nepal has a monsoon climate, and in the summer, it can rain several inches in 24 hours, often for days on end. Nepalis love the monsoon, for the rains bring water for irrigation and good crops. But if you're a team leader for an evaluation project and your colleagues come from here as experts in their field, the monsoon is a challenge. As an expert, you stay in five-star hotels, eat the best food, get servants to do everything, and avoid being in torrential downpours, and always make sure you're back in the hotel in the evening for drinks and a shower. My colleagues were quite explicit. They had to be back in their clean, dry, warm Kathmandu hotel rooms in the evenings. I didn't like living the high life with very marginalized people around us. I was even sadder that it was difficult to do what was required of us, namely to visit the sites of the project. Now, this element of the development set, where you live in a lifestyle that you couldn't afford back home, was new to me. We needed to visit some remote village sites to evaluate the project, and if no other evaluator would go with me, I decided to go with one of the project staff. So off I went with my Nepali colleague and I, ascending a muddy hillside in the pouring rain. After crossing some fast-flowing rivers and climbing up about 5,000 feet and clearing a ridge, it was getting dark, and my Nepali project worker and I went into one of the little tea houses that dot the hillsides in Kabre Palanchok district. This is southeast of Kathmandu. I was thoroughly soaked, chilled, and welcomed the warm fire. Sitting there, speaking Nepali with the others present, I suddenly smiled and felt right. The sadness had lifted. I beamed and felt alive for the first time in several months, and I wondered if it was the cleansing monsoon rain that was responsible. That night, I slept on a straw mat and awoke refreshed the next morning for the first time in a long while. Today I understand why my depression had lifted, and I'll speak about that later. While working as a doctor in Nepal in the 1970s and 80s, I was impressed with how little mental illness I saw. I rarely saw clinical depression, the kind of problem I was suffering from in 1993, nor much anxiety, and little of what might be termed craziness. There were a variety of unusual people in the villages, such as shamans, who might be considered weird or crazy here, but they had a role in society there. There was also the occasional mentally challenged person. We used to call them retarded, but we need more politically correct terms here today. Someone called in Nepali a lato, who was a member of the family and had chores to do, such as tend goats, carry water, fetch wood. I almost never saw anyone mock such a person. It was quite a contrast for me, as I remember growing up, where there was a kind, gentle man with cerebral palsy, Elwood, who walked the streets, and some of us made fun of his gait and disarticulate speech. I didn't see this in Nepal. The other interesting aspect of Nepal was that it was rare to hear a baby or an infant cry for any length of time. To begin with, a baby or infant is worn by the mother. It's almost always with her. If a baby or infant fussed, it's immediately handled, put to the breast, or a soiled piece of clothing washed out. This almost always took care of the problem. When I was there with my four-month-old son in Nepal in a remote village, and when we couldn't comfort him, sometimes we let him cry. The Nepalis thought this was child abuse, and reflecting back upon it, perhaps it was. Children in rural areas of much of the poorer part of the world are always attended to, usually by the mother and otherwise by members of the extended family. Soon after birth, the baby is in eye contact with the mother and at her breast. Breastfeeding often continues until the age of 4 or 5. So I saw a little mental illness in Nepal. I learned in medical school that psychoses, craziness, and the like occurs at the same rates everywhere in the world, while neuroses, the more minor afflictions of the spirit, vary in different places. That was not my sense in Nepal. During my travels, I spent time with other doctors there and would ask them how often they saw a serious mental illness. They agreed it was rare. Traditional Nepali views of craziness, in men at least, was much different than ours. Many believed it took 40 drops of blood to make a drop of brain, and 40 drops of brain to make a drop of sperm. So if someone was crazy, it was because they had ejaculated too much. So in the denizens of Nepal at the turn of the last century, this was the diagnosis for craziness, namely too much ejaculation, and a reason why men would come to my clinic complaining of nocturnal emissions. So different cultures throughout the world are characterized by different belief systems of what causes mental illness. In the U.S., we are now told that mental illness results from a chemical imbalance in the brain. So as an ER doc in the 1990s, I began to see a lot of people on what became known as SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the class of drugs that increase the level of serotonin, this biochemical, in synapses in the nervous system that supposedly make you feel better. Prozac or fluoxetine was the initial drug in this class, and now there are many others such as sertraline or Zoloft, citalopram or Celexa, escitalopram or Lexapro, and paroxing or Paxil. Today I estimate that about a quarter of the adult patients I see in the ER are on these drugs. From drug use surveys, I found that the number of the adult U.S. population on antidepressants is over 10%. About 1 in 10 adults take an antidepressant in this country. Children take antidepressants at younger and younger ages. In fact, drug companies push these drugs so much that we prescribe them to preschool-age children at 5 times the rate in the United Kingdom, for example. So there appears to be more mental illness in the U.S. than ever before, and more than in other countries. How do we know that? The most comprehensive study on this topic was conducted by the World Health Organization and published 2 years ago in the Journal of the American Medical Association, one of the two most respected U.S. sources. It compared mental illness and serious mental illness among 14 countries, both rich and poor. Trained investigators did face-to-face household surveys of over 60,000 people from 2001 to 2003, And they found the U.S. led the world in the percentage reporting some symptoms of mental illness over the previous year, that is 26.4%, and also in the proportion reporting serious mental illness, 7.7%. Surprisingly, the U.S. was also the leader in the numbers of people on treatment for mental illness, with 15% in therapy. So we have the most mental illness of all countries studied, as well as the most treatment. Now, I never rely on just one study, but try to find confirmatory and conflicting evidence. We consume the most mental illness drugs, certainly among the antidepressants and others as well. That suggests serious problems if we also have the most mental illness. Also, we have many studies showing that mental ill health is increasing in the United States over the last decade and more. The Surgeon General's 1999 report on mental illness said over 20% of the United States had psychiatric illness based on older data, and given the increases that we've observed, the above study's 26% figure is realistic. I think what the reports demonstrate is real, and not just because we're more attuned to mental illness in the United States. Can the treatment for mental illness, especially drug treatment, perhaps be making us worse, since we don't seem to be getting better mentally as a society? That is, our rates of mental illness are going up. It could also be that there's something in society, a plague, if you will, that is causing more mental illness. And I want to consider both those issues. If we consider those in this hall as a representative sample of our country, about 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 of you have had mental illness in the last year. Many listening may be treated in various ways and find the treatments helpful. It's a conundrum. Now, I've spent the last 15 years asking questions such as, what makes a population healthy? What good does medical care do to a population? And now I ask, why do we have the most mental illness? First, let's look at how we treat mental illness. Our society focuses on drugs, partly because this perspective has resulted in our pharmaceutical industry producing an almost endless variety of lifestyle drugs for everything that ails us. And we want fast, fast, fast relief, as one of the radio ads I heard in my youth promised. The happy pills, typified by Prozac, are widely promoted and used beginning at an early age. These drugs have a variety of significant side effects, but they're vastly popular in the United States compared to other countries. Other nations don't use them as much as we do, and they have less depression and less mental illness, according to the studies. Although the drugs are intended to treat depression, if you look at the advertisements where you're to ask your doctor about and look in the long list of side effects, it includes depression and suicide. We take a drug for depression, and one of the side effects may be depression. Does that make sense? The U.S. is the only country in the world that permits this direct-to-consumer advertising of drugs in magazines and on TV, for example. This practice has been immensely profitable for the drug industry and may be partly responsible for many deaths of Americans from overuse of drugs, the legal kind, which far exceed deaths from legal drugs. Investigations in the United States show that about one death in 20 is legal drug-related. The disclaimer I can't repeat too many times is, if you're using drugs for mental illness, I'm not telling you to stop taking them. Another common class of agents used are those such as Ritalin for ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. I see more and more young people and even older people on these drugs. Over 10% of school children are on these stimulants. And I'm told stories of schools that say to parents, if you don't put your kids on these drugs, we won't let them come to school. We appear to have the highest rates of ADHD of any country. Whenever you find the United States excelling in such conditions, you have to ask why these problems occur at high rates instead of just accepting that we need more treatment. We must look at what we do in this country compared with other countries in order to see what's happening. That is what population health is all about, looking at how different populations do things to influence their health. In the United States, studies show that office visits to doctors where youth are treated by antipsychotic drugs, these are the ones for serious mental illness, have increased sixfold from 1993 to 2002. In less than 10 years, the number of youth treated with drugs for mental illness in the United States increased 6 times. More than twice as many males were put on them as females, and over 3 times as many white non-Hispanics as others. Now, these heavy hitter drugs that we're talking about are the so-called atypical neuroleptics or second-generation antipsychotic medicines and include olanzapine or Zyprexa, clozapine or Clozaril, risperidone or Risperdal, and quetiapine or Seroquel. Notice how all these advertising or brand names are cleverly crafted to sound like they're doing something wonderful. Risperdal, Seroquel, wow. The initial class of antipsychotic drugs called phenothiazines were used in the 1950s and 60s, and they helped release patients from mental hospitals. There are many other data showing that we in the United States consume more and more drugs for mental conditions. There's been a 40-fold increase in the rates of in the sales of antidepressants and antipsychotics from 1986 to 2004. During this period, the number of mentally disabled people didn't even double, but sales for these drugs increased 40-fold. If we look at students attending counseling centers in colleges, almost 25% were taking psychiatric medicines in 2003-2004 compared to only 9% in 1994. Nearly a tripling of college students taking mental illness drugs has occurred in only 10 years. Something's wrong. There's clearly a need among us for dealing with what is happening to us, as the evidence demonstrates. But are we one nation under drug therapy? Do we live in a pharmacocracy? I don't want to get into a detailed discussion of whether these drugs actually work as intended. However, studies on drugs used to treat mental illness in the United States do demonstrate short-term benefits. But in the long term, drugs for mental illness may in fact create more problems than without their use. Such a statement is, of course, controversial, but many neuroscientists believe that psychiatric drugs induce a pathologic or sick state, and I tend to agree with them. There's a substantial scientific literature that is concerned with the heavy use of these drugs and the potential harm they may cause. Taking them for a long time may in itself cause mental problems. Studies beginning in the 1960s have shown lower relapse rates for those treated with a placebo or a sugar pill rather than the antipsychotics. Today, there's strong evidence for considering not using antipsychotic drugs for initial treatment of schizophrenia, for example. And long term, there may be some advantage as well. There may be subgroups of patients that require drugs, but a substantial number will do better without them. Like many aspects of treatment today, it's best individualized rather than following standardized guidelines. But with mass medical care, there's little effort made to tailor treatments to the specifics of the person, their family, and the community. So today, antidepressants may cause serious mental illness in many treated patients. Such data begin as case reports, where worse depression, mania, aggression, violence, and suicide occur in treated patients. Trying to come up with precise estimates of how often this occurs is difficult. But in some studies, this appears to be close to 20%, and there's great variability, as with any medical research. And of course, this topic is very controversial, too. Now, just as I've delved into studies of medical care on health and found medical care commonly harms people, it's something we don't address in society, and I think the same is true for the use of drugs for mental illness. That is, in many cases, it may make the problem worse. Standards of mental illness care have also changed over the last few decades. The Bible for making a diagnosis of mental illness is called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, in term the DSM for short. The current revision, the fourth, lays out the criteria to make a diagnosis and how you may want to treat. We've changed the criteria, so now, for example, if your child were to die, or your spouse, or your parent, you can expect to feel intense feelings that are called bereavement. How long is normal bereavement for such a tragedy supposed to last? When my brother died, my mother never stopped grieving. She was bereaved for over 40 years until she died. When my sister-in-law died, my wife was grieving for at least a year. According to the DSM-4, normal bereavement for loss of a close family member only lasts for 2 months. If you haven't gotten over it by then, you're a candidate for drug therapy. Now, in the previous revision in 1980, normal bereavement lasted a year. But like everything else in society, whether it's fast food or fast travel or faster computers or faster internet or faster medical care, normal bereavement is now much quicker. So get over it. The DSM is written by those who have financial ties to the drug companies, and that may be one reason for faster bereavement. We appear to have an invisible plague in this country, one whose impact is not that of the typical plague caused by a bacterium transmitted by a flea that lives on rats and causes buboes or festering sores. You know, we can't see this scourge the way we see physical trauma or the wasting of cancer or the disfigurement from a spinal cord injury. Daniel Defoe, writing in his Journal of the Plague Year, 1722, says, "A plague is a formidable enemy and is armed with terrors that every man is not sufficiently fortified to resist or stand the shock against." Do we have a plague of mental illness, but one that appears invisible? Epidemics can be obvious and visible, such as the great flu epidemic of 1918, during which in 1 month, 195,000 Americans died. And we worry this will repeat itself soon with avian flu. But today I see evidence of a plague in this country, in that summer is just over. And summer is a time when if you work with children who go to summer camps, you observe that something is quite different than when you went to camp 3 or 4 decades ago. I recall taking my daughter to the drop-off point a few years ago, and there were two lines. One was very short, and the other was very long. I wondered what line I should stand in and I was asked whether I had prescription drugs to drop off for my daughter or whether they just needed to verify her identity. The line of children going off to summer camp who needed prescription medicines safeguarded was very long. And I recall nothing like this when I went to camp many years ago. About half of campers today take some prescription medicines, with about half of those being drugs for allergies and asthma, and the rest are for mental disorders. Almost a quarter of campers, according to a company that handles medicines for summer campers, need psychiatric drugs. There's something going wrong with our children and the society in which they live to produce this level of dysfunction. Friends who were traveling on airplanes this summer told me about the presence of animals, usually dogs, with passengers on planes. What's going on here? These are not blind people, but in fact those who require emotional support animals. Airplanes, restaurants, even workplaces are now required by a ruling from the Department of Transportation passed in 2003 as an extension of the Americans with Disability Act to provide for emotional support animals to accompany humans. We doctors have recommended animals for emotional support to help bring comfort to the afflicted. Such people then find it difficult to live without their constant presence. It might not be just a dog. American Airlines reports that they have to accommodate monkeys, miniature horses, cats, and even an emotional support duck, not to mention a goat. All you need is a letter from a mental health professional and the animal flies free in the cabin. There may be some of you here tonight that require such support, and I'm not trying to make fun of you, but I'm looking at the big picture. The need for emotional support animals suggests that our capacity for forming and maintaining supportive human relationships is on the wane. This is a societal, not an individual problem, but in this country, we blame the individual for almost everything. In previous talks, I pointed out that we in this country are less healthy than pretty well all the other rich countries and a few poor ones. And there are many studies demonstrating that mental illness makes physical illness worse. And mental illness also decreases our ability to interact socially and influences important decisions we make. So mental illness takes a huge toll on our society. Few dispute this, although an occasional shrink suggests that our self-help culture is eroding self-reliance. I believe the problems are real. They don't reflect a weak moral character, but are a response to the conditions created in the United States that stand out in stark contrast to the situation in other countries in what I call the Health Olympics. Since we're less healthy than the other rich countries and die much younger than we should, the fact that we lead the world in mental ill health should not be surprising. So there is a plague upon us. It's visible. But as George Orwell said, to see what is in front of your nose requires a constant struggle. There are several obvious reasons for this scourge. And I want to look at a more upstream explanation or root cause for why America is driving us crazy. I think our society has become a very difficult environment to cope with, given all the stresses and expectations. The term stress was brought into popular use in the 1950s by Hans Selye as a new concept. Humans seem to have endless capacity to adapt to increasing stress, although we do so in creative individual ways, such as having an emotional support duck, rather than in structuring society to be more conducive to human relationships. So all is not eternal bliss in our society today, as was suggested by the decline of the work week in the 1960s and 70s. Although our Declaration of Independence describes this nation as entitled to the pursuit of happiness, the evidence shows that our happiness has been slowly and steadily declining over the last 40 years. Something's gone wrong. Instead of pursuing happiness, our society is controlling our behavior with joy-numbing drugs that I can prescribe to patients, as well as the drug of mass culture. In the book Brave New World, Aldous Huxley wrote that soma is the drug that was given to everyone so they were numb to society's condition, numb to its social problems. Today, our soma are not just pharmaceuticals treating mental illness, but all the other mass agents with which we numb our minds, be they video games, reality TV, Game Boys, violent movie fantasies, living in gated communities, five-star hotels, or tuning out on an iPod. Huxley described a society with immense social problems where soma blunted the pain that people might feel about the situation. The people were happy and got what they wanted and never wanted what they could not get. Soma had, quote, all the advantages of Christianity and alcohol, but none of their defects. We need to consider how these matters are handled in other countries, how other countries look at mental illness and its treatment. I've spoken about my experiences in Nepal, but what about other rich countries? In Great Britain, they don't use treatments for which there isn't a preponderance of evidence for their benefits. There's a great deal of depression and anxiety there, but less than we have. They found that the best treatment is a kind of talk therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, done with well-trained therapists. It works with half of depressives and requires 16 one-hour sessions over 4 months. And these people never need treatment again unless a relapse occurs in later years. The treatment costs less than $1,000 a person and is much less expensive with fewer side effects than the drug therapy we use here. We prefer antidepressants, which are exorbitantly expensive and have major side effects, and they're part of our profit care system of providing medical services. Over in England, they choose a less expensive and more effective way of dealing with the problem. While we do use these talk therapies, often in conjunction with drugs, it's more efficient here to focus on pills. And in this country, such treatments are less available to those with lower incomes, who also happen to bear the brunt of most mental illness. So this is how the U.S. differs from other rich countries, which make these treatments available to all, as the United Kingdom example points out. When I talk to academic psychiatrists in this country about whether or not the United States has more mental illness than other nations, they often hedge and say it's very hard to tell. Serious mental illness, the kind termed schizophrenia, does have different prevalence or commonalities throughout the world, unlike what I was taught in medical school. New studies demonstrate that it isn't the same the world over. Real craziness or schizophrenia is more common in rich countries and more common in urban settings and less common in rural poor countries, exactly what I'd surmised based on my observations in Nepal and the United States. So we're in the midst of an invisible plague of mental illness, and we can only see it if we look for indirect markers, such as the number of psychiatric drugs being used in this country, or the number of emotional support animals that accompany victims of this plague, or the numbers of people surveyed who have mental illness. Like many indicators of adverse or bad health, we lead the world, and I'm standing up here not free of this plague, as I confessed in the beginning. Now, younger people in the audience may be wondering, what's the big deal? Yeah, lots of you or your friends are taking these drugs. It's just the way things are. Ritalin helps people concentrate. There's a ready market for those of you on these legal stimulants who want to sell some of your supply. You figure either take them or alcohol or take pot, crack, or heroin, but the prescription drugs as well as alcohol are legal. The other half of you, probably closer to my age, are asking, it wasn't this way when I was a kid. What's wrong? Thomas Pynchon wrote in Gravity's Rainbow, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers. we should be asking what's wrong. Instead, the usual response is saying we need more treatment. And I'm suggesting treatment isn't working. So why else might we be more mentally unbalanced or crazier than people in other countries? Well, most of our political policies could be considered insane. With more poverty in our midst than any other rich country, we're cutting taxes on the rich and on rich corporations to make them even richer. We could be taxing more and spending this money in better ways, as I'll point out later. We have half the world's billionaires, despite being 5% of the world's population. So we're doing well in wealth creation. Giving ever more to the rich people in this country is a core problem that's driving us crazy. It's making our foreign and domestic policy sick and having the same impact on ordinary people, you and I. So how is giving ever more to the rich making us mentally sick? It's causing us to demolish factors that have the greatest impact on our health, both mental and physical, especially in the way we treat early childhood. We're destroying effective early childhood for the bulk of society in the United States, and we pay the price for the rest of our lives. This amazing science has emerged from the groundswell in knowledge occurring in the decade of the brain. After the Second World War, a British psychiatrist, John Bowlby, was studying orphans. Before the war, he'd been looking at thieves and juvenile delinquents and found a consistent pattern among them of permanent separation from their mothers or mother substitutes during early life. He had a control group of people as well, and this rarely happened among them. Now, many of our advances in understanding health and disease come about this way. We look at groups that have the condition and those that don't for insight. After the war, he began his work for the World Health Organization on children who'd been orphaned because of the war. And in the early 1950s, he wrote, "For the moment, it is sufficient to say that what is believed to be essential for mental health is that the infant and young child should experience a warm, intimate, and continuous relationship with his mother or permanent mother substitute in which both find satisfaction and enjoyment." By permanent mother substitute, he meant one person who steadily mothers him. And he recognized a continuous relationship between a mother and child in which both find happiness and satisfaction promotes mental health. He also realized that whoever is there with the infant in the initial primary attachment should also be accessible in later years, preferably well into adulthood. Bowlby felt the same instinct to stay close to one's mother and the intimate relationship they form was the same instinct that allowed one to form close relationships throughout one's life. So attachment begins soon after birth. The baby opens its eyes and searches for another pair of eyes. Newborns don't have great vision, but they can distinguish black and white. Who's the only primate species with whites in their eyes? No other ape, monkey, or humanoid has whites in their eyes. Suppose I was standing up here speaking to you wearing sunglasses. How would you react to what I'm saying? How do you feel if you meet a stranger and they wear sunglasses? Eye contact is critical for human interaction. Are you looking at me? Do you have my attention? Do you think I'm foolish? We get so much information from eye contact. I recall a famous photographer saying that in a photo with people in it, it was critical that one pair of eyes be in focus. I used to think that eye contact was most important in adults. It is more critical in the first part of life in establishing contact with a single individual human. The baby can distinguish black and white. They can recognize that person and whether the same one as before. I could show you just the eyes of the picture of the woman in Afghanistan that was in National Geographic, taken by Steve McCurry, and you would recognize who I mean. The eyes have it, and they have it very early in life. If the same pair of eyes is there in front of the newborn time and time again, a bond of secure attachment forms. Attachment patterns have been classified as secure or insecure or disorganized. A child who's securely attached to its parent will explore freely while the parent is present, will engage with strangers, will be visibly upset when the parent departs, and happy to see the parent return. Such a child explores their world knowing they have a secure base to return to when needed. This is a healthy attachment style. Insecure attachment is more likely when the same pair of eyes is not consistently there. Such children are anxious of exploring and not so happy among strangers, even when the attachment figure is present. Or they avoid or ignore the parent figure and shun exploration. These children have very limited emotional range. They're either anxious ambivalent or anxious avoidant insecure attachment. At least they have a way of trying to cope with their environment. But some children are totally disorganized in their attachment and are either constantly frightened or frightening. It's like the child is looking into a mirror and is broken into pieces. I think, that is, we don't have good studies here, I think ADHD may have its beginnings in the disorganized form of attachment. We now understand that the newborn is hardwired to develop the visual part of their brain before the other sensory parts. The right brain is more visual, intuitive, and looking at the whole picture instead of its parts. The right physical hemisphere of the brain grows the most during the first year of life, and the left catches up in a few years. And the visual cortex is the most active part of the sensory aspect of our brain early on, and this is the part that processes sight. Now, the nature versus nurture puzzle is often debated. I think the evidence strongly points to nurture being probably more important than nature. At least we have a complementary situation in which Mother Nature meets Mother Nurture. So nurture facilitates nature. Research suggests that while the mother is key in the first year of life, there's another attachment process that occurs in the second year to the father or another caregiver, which fine-tunes mood and emotion regulation. And these patterns are stored in memory in the brain to be used later in coping with stressful situations in both passive ways that we're unaware of or in active ways. Studies show that if there's early loss of a parent and poor quality family relationships, there's an unhealthy response to stressful situations later in life, as well as problems with emotions and increased pain sensitivity. So infant mental health is really about healthy social and emotional development. And if this doesn't go well, there'll be problems early on and or later in life. To have a healthy brain, to have mental health, one needs to develop within a relationship with another brain. The evidence suggests it can't be many brains, but really one and then two brains are needed that are critical for mental health. Traditionally, this is the mother and the father. It could be the nanny and his friend, providing they continue to be present later in life. Now, Bowlby was criticized for suggesting the mother was needed, and today that concept is lost in our society where we find ourselves with women increasingly required to not only be mothers, but career women, super jocks, homemakers, and perfect wives, just plain super women. No wonder it becomes impossible, and we all suffer. One hears a great deal about an enriched environment for developing healthy children. Usually this relates to the physical environment, games, puzzles, physical challenges. I think these are good for our intellectual development, but less effective for developing emotional maturity and the positive affect that's required to cope with today's stressful lifestyle. You may now have a glimpse of why we need so many drugs that act on the nervous system to control unruly behavior in children. The drugs for ADHD, for example, or for depression in tiny tots, and when they grow up, they need Seroquel and their emotional support animal. I believe that in many cases, it's because their emotional development was not ideal. The right brain did not develop the capacity to enter into emotional communications with others. They suffered with problems with their mood, and this leads to a situation that cannot be cured when they're adults. So secure attachment early on develops capacity for resilience to deal with the vastly increased stress of living in today's society. Whatever happened to us early in life, we can't rewind to see exactly how early life was for us and have to do the best we can with what we've got. The mentality in the United States is that no matter what, we can fix it right now. Our national state of mental ill health suggests that isn't true. A large number of us take drugs for mental illness, but they cannot redress what happened in those early years. So I've talked about the importance of the first year or two of life in creating conditions for good mental health. Why do we have the most mental illness of all countries studied? Perhaps in spite of the rhetoric, we don't have the right early childhood experiences programmed into how society functions in the United States of America. Could it be that in spite of all the talk, we don't have family values in place? Those are strong deterrents to having good health, both mental and physical. And of course, there are other indicators of how poorly children fare in this country compared to other rich countries. We have the highest proportion of children living in poverty, the highest rates of homelessness among children, the highest rates of death from child abuse. We have twice the teen birth rate of the next closest rich country. We have the highest rates of child injury deaths. So it should be no surprise, too, that we have the highest infant mortality rate, the highest child mortality rate, and the highest youth homicide rate. We medicate our children with psychoactive drugs such as Ritalin, Zyprexia, and Paxil, and we use them more than in other countries. So what might we do to improve the outcomes for our children so they have better mental and physical health and grow into emotionally and mentally healthy adults? Public health calls this primary prevention. One thing to consider is what policies do other countries who are much healthier than we are have in place? There are only three countries in the world without a paid maternity leave policy. United States, Swaziland, a very poor African country, and Papua New Guinea, half of a large island north of Australia. We're the wealthiest country in the world, yet we have no policy that guarantees that a working mom, after she has her baby, can stay home to nurture the baby and get paid while doing so. Only a very poor African country and a poor Asian country side with us here. And that's a disgrace. Take Sweden, a very healthy country. What do they do to ensure a thriving early childhood? They mandate a full year's combined maternity and paternity leave with full pay. You have to take it, and you get your full pay from the government. If the mother takes the full year, then the father has to take 12 weeks as well. The second year is optional at 80% pay. Then if you want to go back to work, your child is put in a government-run free daycare. The requirements to work in a Swedish daycare setting is that you need a master's degree in play. That is what daycare should be about, socializing with others, and we need experts there. The only requirement for daycare workers in the United States that I'm aware of is that there be no recent history of sexual abuse of children. So we get what we pay for. Now, healthier countries don't mandate secure attachment for children, but they make it much more likely to happen than here, since there's little chance of a parent being there for the child in the U.S., especially since we undid welfare as we knew it, and we don't have a living wage policy in this country. If there are two parents in the home, they both need to work to try to make ends meet, since real wages have been stagnant for most of the last 30 years. So the price we pay for neglecting early childhood is immense. It affects us personally for the rest of our lives, and may be the reason we use psychoactive drugs to keep us under control in Brave New World. Now, because the most important part of our physical and mental health occurs before we're able to make conscious choices, such as to eat right, to exercise, to not smoke, to use a condom, there's really not much that adhering to such individual health advice can do to redress a couple of critical years at the beginning. So I've talked about early childhood and suggested we don't value it and neglect spending public funds to support good conditions early on so we have healthier lives as adults. There are also many studies looking at the impact of the gap between the rich and the poor on adult mental health. More inequality in society, a bigger discrepancy between the have too muches and have not enoughs, has been related to more mental illness. One study demonstrates the link between income distribution and mental ill health among the rich countries where the U.S. stood out as having the most mental illness. There's more stress in such societies, and the stress is concentrated on the more disadvantaged, poorer elements who can't cope and have more mental illness. But these ideas are overlooked in the United States because we're indoctrinated to believe that no matter what, no matter when, we can all pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and get over it. I no longer believe that, and there isn't evidence for that either. Now, I began talking about a period of depression I had in 1993 and how it was resolved. I then talked about studies showing how much mental illness we have in this country and how our efforts to deal with it might be making it worse. I also talked about how we characterize mental illness and pointed out that what happens to us early in life has profound effects on our health and mental stability. Now, how mental illness is seen in this country has changed, and this is transforming standards of care throughout the world. When I went to medical school in 1970, there was a joke told about the very specialties in medicine. The pathologist, you know, the doctor that does autopsies. The pathologist is the doctor that knows everything, but 2 hours too late. In other words, she finds out what the problem is after the person has died. The internist is the doctor that knows everything, but does nothing. And the surgeon is the doctor that knows nothing, but does everything. And the psychiatrist was the doctor that knows nothing and does nothing. Now, all that has changed except for the pathologist. She still knows everything, but still 2 hours too late. Internists tell me they still know everything, but now they do all sorts of invasive procedures, sticking scopes and catheters into various places. And surgeons, my colleagues tell me, have learned a great deal these days and often don't do anything. A good example is the trauma service at Harborview, where almost everyone who used to come in there with serious injuries went to the operating room where the motto was, if in doubt, cut it out. Today we've learned that just leaving you alone is better for many injuries. We used to always remove a ruptured spleen, but these days that operation is very rare. The psychiatrist has been encumbered with ideas from the DSM that almost all mental illness is a result of a chemical imbalance in the brain that needs drug therapy. So today, psychiatrists know a lot about pharmacologic psychiatry and do almost everything to treat America's ills. But when I did my rotation in psychiatry as a medical student at Stanford in 1973, I worked in a hospital ward in Palo Alto called a therapeutic community. There were a bunch of crazy people there as patients. They didn't wear hospital gowns, but ordinary clothes. And psychiatrists and others treated them there. The days were spent in various social events and community meetings. Yes, many of the patients were on drugs, but the therapy took place in various meetings in which social encounters happened and were discussed. Depression at that time was considered involutional or reactive. Involutional is a fancy word meaning coming from within, and reactive is after bad things happen to you. After medical school and further training and then working in various settings, be they hospital ERs or clinics or teaching other doctors, I was not aware that this perspective on treating mental illness had changed until I read the book The Age of Melancholy by Dr. Blaser, a professor of psychiatry at Duke University. He looked at the transition from social psychiatry to biological psychiatry that began happening in the 1970s. Once we had drugs with different side effects from the obvious movement disorders of the 1960s drugs and appeared to acceptably control some forms of behavior, psychiatrists no longer had to do nothing. They had a pill for almost every ill. And with DSM-3, the manual telling psychiatrists how to classify illness that was out in 1980, major depression became divorced from the community and society. It was just a chemical imbalance and easy to become diagnosed with, as I found in 1993. Now, major depression is the common cold of psychiatry. While there are lots of drugs to treat it, they may not be any more effective in the long run than in how we treat the common cold. Therapeutic communities are no more. A psychiatric colleague of mine just came back from a stint in New Zealand where she worked in one of the last therapeutic communities there. They're being phased out because it's easier to just give people pills rather than pay for community therapy. Now, New Zealand is healthier than the United States, but our standards of life and medical care are penetrating everywhere, including down under. Other nations who have better mental health than we do want to emulate our sad state of how we treat illness. So to get out of this morass, we need to rethink mental as well as physical health and come to see that what happens in society matters at least as much as what the individual does. Many people diagnosed with major depression and on antidepressants are in fact having reactive depressions. They do not just have a chemical imbalance that requires soma in our brave new world pharmacocracy. Instead, they need therapeutic communities. In 1993, I had what would have once been termed a reactive depression, but I was very fortunate to have friends and a meaningful work to do, challenging work that required me to be a part of a community. And eventually in the therapeutic community of Hill, Nepal, I got over it. I think what is responsible for much mental ill health in this country is that we are losing the capacity to be a part of stable communities and to engage in meaningful things to do. I think we need a therapeutic community, or better still, a therapeutic society. So what would today's therapeutic society look like? It has to be physical. Virtual ones won't do. I know you can have online dating and online sex, and there's less likelihood of catching herpes that way, but we need stable face-to-face, flesh-to-flesh encounters. Over the last few decades, our society has changed, so we have fewer meaningful social encounters than ever before. The ones we have often have no more depth than those where we tell people to have a nice day. Many of you who are older will recall that we didn't used to wish everyone every time, whether on the phone, in the chat room, on the street, to have a nice day. Occasionally, I tell them, thank you very much, but that isn't what I had planned. Occasionally, I want to have a miserable day so I can appreciate the next day when things are better. Are people having nice days? Evidence suggests not. We must change the structure of society by making our relationships involve community, respect, friendship, and support. You are much less likely to have those relationships with a big gap between the rich and the poor. So the key treatment today for our poor state of physical and mental health, mental well-being, will require decreasing the income gap, the upstream factor that will do the most for our health. We have many studies linking inequality to worse mental health, and of course, it tends to be the poorer people in the society who suffer the most. Why is inequality increasing almost everywhere in the world? The USA has been a leader once again in this process, and the reason goes back to the adoption of neoliberal economic theories beginning in the 1970s. The rich and powerful have only wanted one thing all throughout history, and that's everything. After the Second World War, many forms of redistribution came into being, taking from the rich and giving to the poor. Robin Hood was alive and well. Beginning around 1965 until 1980, the rich saw their total assets decline. It was a wealth crash. So they responded with a series of policies, what that's now termed neoliberal economics, that gave them ever more. Instead of Robin Hood, they incarnated Hood Robin. They told us this was best for everyone. If they got more than their share, it would be better for all of us. Now, most people in the United States think this is the way it should be, giving up what they have to the rich. A therapeutic society would bring Robin Hood back. This would extend the concept of primary prevention I mentioned earlier to primordial prevention, getting at the root causes of our society's dysfunction. But today I want you to take a smaller problem that I've spelled out and work to change that. Let the only countries in the world without a paid maternity leave policy be Papua New Guinea and Swaziland, and not the United States. Better still, we should make sure that every country in the world has a paid maternity leave policy. A small change. Let's do what Sweden does and mandate a full year's paid leave for mothers and fathers. It might take giving up some tax cuts for billionaires, but the price is worth it. So I've talked about mental health and mental illness by considering populations and societies rather than what an individual should do when she or he has a problem. People with various issues often ask me for advice. I think we need forms of support and community and meaning in our lives. I was lucky back in 1993 to have challenging work to do, that I was eager to begin even in my unwell state. Our society, this country, has exported plenty of meaningful work to China, India, and Bangladesh. The Rust Belt and depressed economies in this country attest to that. Treating depressed economies with trickle-down neoliberal economics Hood Robin politics won't work as well as Robin Hood treating society. We also used to accommodate many of those with mental illness in halfway houses, special places to stay where they had supervised activities. But in the world's richest country, we've decided to no longer fund those and have ousted their occupants onto the street, where you see many of them regularly today. So I've suggested that the studies demonstrating that the United States has the highest rates of mental illness are true, and part of the reason is our over-reliance on drugs to treat a condition that in large part results from the rules we've laid out in our society. These rules create conditions in early childhood that don't lead to emotionally stable adults. The policies create very stressful societies as well. The desire to give as much as we can to the rich, with the rest of us being satisfied with what trickles down, is the root cause. We find our lives increasingly focused on being consumers, working ourselves to death, to have more stuff that doesn't satisfy our needs for emotional support or mental health. Our Surgeon General's report on mental health echoes these ideas, yet we vote against our interests in well-being. So America is driving us crazy,